Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Brett Scharfs, and I will be chairing this breakout session. In this room, we will be talking about working with state and local governments on religious freedom issues. There are three different breakout sessions, and there will be two iterations of them. So basically, what we'd like everyone to do is to choose two of the three, and we'll have the first meet here for the next hour from 1 o'clock to 2 o'clock. We'll then have a 15-minute break, and then we will have the second set of sessions beginning at 2:15 as scheduled. Because these are breakout sessions, the attendance will be really only about a third of what we had for the larger sessions. So feel free to work your way a little closer. We can have a little bit more intimate discussion if you'd like. And our plan is to give each of our presenters a few minutes to present their views on the topic, which is working with state and local governments on religious freedom issues. And then our intention is to really have a conversation, to really give you expansive opportunities to ask questions and to get feedback from the panel. So our hope is that we will really have an interactive type of situation where you can really ask the questions that are on your mind, and we can get a variety of views in discussing those issues. As we begin, we're going to have three brief presentations to start. The first will be the Honorable J. Stuart Adams from the United States, the Utah State Senate. Sorry to have just about promoted you. Then R. Michael Purdy, the Director of Government and Strategic Relations in the Public Affairs Department of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And our third speaker will be Robin Fretwell Wilson, a law professor at the University of Illinois College of Law. So let me just let each of you speak in turn, and then I will moderate the discussion. Senator Adams.
If I can, I'm going to defer to Michael Purdy. I think he's going to go first.
Well, good afternoon. It's very nice to be here with you. As was mentioned earlier, my name is Michael Purdy. I serve as the Government Relations Director for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And I've been asked to speak this afternoon just for a few minutes to talk about the Church's role as a stakeholder in the legislation passed in Utah regarding non-discrimination and religious freedom, and what our interest was in that and our attitude towards it. So for years, church leaders have been speaking about the need to protect religious freedom. And at the same time, they have also spoken about making sure that these type of difficult issues were addressed in a spirit of civil dialogue and respectful treatment for those who disagree. And many academics and reporters have covered the growing conflict between religious freedom rights and primarily LGBT issues related to marriage, housing, and employment. And over the last couple of years, we've seen states and municipalities grapple with these issues, and sometimes with very less than satisfying results. Whenever it seems a religious freedom issue was brought up at that level, a lot of debate and a lot of animosity and very little positive was accomplished. Too often, I think this discussion was done in a way that led to a zero-sum game. Two sides of this issue were always pitted against each other as if one had to win and the other had to lose. We saw that play out in various places across the country, and competing interests between advocates of religious freedom and those seeking to build LGBT rights into law led to legislative inaction or stalemate with increasing frequency across the United States, and church leaders thought there had to be a better way. One that would allow the church to remain true to its doctrines and beliefs while participating in a democratic process that would allow both sides to come together to debate and to compromise and to find a solution that hopefully in the end all could feel well about. Now, as a general practice, the church does not weigh in on legislative matters to this detail as we did this last Utah legislative session. And even more rarely does the church voice official support for any specific piece of legislation. However, in this case, senior church leaders announced support for SB 296 and 297 specifically in Utah earlier this year. This was done in a press conference that called on a fairness for all approach, one that would protect the rights of all to the degree possible, where under the belief that if everybody got 90% of what they wanted, that was a win, rather than one side getting 100% and the other side feeling left out of the process. Such an approach, we thought, is keeping with core church doctrines and the time-honored American tradition of compromise. So in this January press conference, church leaders emphasized that doctrines don't change, but suggested, quote, a way forward in which those with different views on these complex issues can together seek for solutions that will be fair to everyone. The content of that press conference, I think, can be summarized in five key points that I'd just like to read for you quickly. The first is that the church will support legislation where it is being sought to provide protections in housing, employment, and some other areas where LGBT people do not have protections, while ensuring that religious freedom is not compromised. Two, that the church believes that a fairness for all approach, which strives to balance reasonable safeguards for LGBT people while protecting key religious rights, is the best way to overcome the sharp divisions and present cultural divide in our nation. The third point is that the church is alarmed at the erosion of religious freedom. When religious people are publicly intimidated, retaliated against, forced from employment, or made to suffer personal loss because they have raised their voice in the public square, donated to a cause, or participated in an election, our democracy is the loser. This is just as wrong as persecution or retaliation against LGBT people. The fourth point we raised was that this appeal for a balanced approach between religious and gay rights does not represent a change or shift in doctrine for the church. It does represent a desire to bring people together to encourage mutually respective dialogue in what has become a highly polarized national debate. And the fifth point was that in this approach, neither side may get all they want. We must all learn to live with others who do not share the same beliefs or values. So during the 2015 Utah legislative session, there were a few bills that had attempted to address either religious freedom or non-discrimination issues. Ultimately, bills were passed, headlined by SB 296 and 297, as I mentioned earlier. And during this time, there was a very rigorous discussion and debate around these bills, and the church participated in some of this debate as a stakeholder in the community. Along with others, including bill sponsors in the House and Senate, as well as leadership in both of those bodies, the Governor's Office, Equality Utah, and the ACLU. While there were significant hurdles to clear, I would like to express sincere thanks for all that were involved during that time. It was a significant time. A lot of time and effort went into it by so many, and I'm grateful to those who were ultimately committed to the process that I'd outlined, this fairness for all approach, and in finding solutions in what came to be known as the Utah Compromise. Some of the headlines we saw after these bills were passed around the country were significant and I think captured the process fairly. For instance, in the Wall Street Journal, the headline was, "Utah shows the way on gay rights." The Washington Post said, "Gay rights, religious rights, and a compromise in an unlikely place, Utah." The New York Times headline read, "Mormons seek golden mean between gay rights and religious beliefs." And in Time magazine, the headline read, "What Indiana Could Learn from Utah About Gay Tolerance." Lastly, the LA Times, "Mormon Church Tries to Balance Gay Rights Protections, Religious Freedom." So there was a lot of interest around the country in what Utah managed to accomplish. Now the debate seems to have gone to whether or not the so-called Utah Compromise is something that can be exported to other states. I believe the answer to that is a resounding yes. Each state will have its own stakeholders. Each state will have its own laws on the book that must be navigated. its own people to do this negotiation. But I think the process that was followed in Utah by getting people around the table, wanting to have a discussion, understanding that the goal here was to find compromise, to find solutions, and to find a fairness for all approach, is something that can be done in any other place. We hope that will happen. It was a great experience to be a part of it here. And I think those that would participate this in other states or other municipalities would find it very rewarding, although challenging. In the end, if we can find the kind of laws that were passed here in Utah, those that seek sincerely to balance rights, to deal with problems when individual or group rights collide with each other, to find ways to compromise and have everyone feel like they've won in that situation. It's only good for democracy and for those who live under those democracies. Thank you very much.
Again, I'd like to thank Michael Purdy and the LDS Church for their leadership. Last legislative session, I think everyone's aware, there was an announcement the second day of the session, and the church stepped forward and led with that fairness for all approach. And without them, and in fact, I'd like to express thanks to many of those that were here, because we walked through this. I'm going to talk a little bit about what we did during that legislative session, but as we walked through it, it is an effort by not just the Utah State Legislature or those that were involved immediately in the negotiation, but by many around the country. And I've always said we've used the best legal minds anywhere in the United States, and especially here in Utah. And those of you that are here are a significant part of that. In Utah, we did recognize, we followed the admonition that was given for fairness for all. We recognize that the rights of some cannot and should not be acquired at the expense of others, and found a balance and equalizing the solution and squaring off religious liberties with LGBT non-discrimination. Now, this next slide shows that balance. I mean, we found protections for employers, we found protections for employees, religious organization, landlords, the LGBT community. We did it through a non-severability effort, and we actually dealt with the marriage issue with some mandates for clerks and some ability to step off from clerks, and we found some actually government efforts to prohibit government retaliation. So I'm going to move through those quickly, or we're not going to have enough time for question and answers. But employer protections. We gave employer protections for addressing grooming standards at work. That was always a question when you extend these rights, how we handle dress and grooming standards. Then we dealt with facilities, reasonable accommodations and facilities. There's lots of legislative intent that was talked about, even just a lock on a bathroom door, to be able to accommodate those. We protected the employer. There's been, well, you'll find about expression at the workplace. We gave the employer control of that expression at the workplace, if you read in the red. There was existing state law that gave exemptions for employers, small employers under 15 employees. We gave total exemption to those small employers. We then dealt with the individual rights of expression. And I may read this slide a little bit. It says, this chapter may not be interpreted to infringe upon the freedoms of expressive association or the free exercise of religion protected by the First Amendment. We actually recodified the First Amendment, the religious protections in the First Amendment, into our state statute. Again, trying to protect those freedoms of expression. And then at the workplace, we gave employees the right to express their religious, and in a balanced way, moral, so we open it up, commitments in the workplace in a reasonable, non-destructive, non-harassing way. And again, the employer regulates that. Outside of the workplace, we've had lots of comments about people being fired for associating with Prop 8. This protection was so significant. An employer may not discharge, demote, terminate, or refuse to hire any person or retaliate against, harass, or discriminate in matters of compensation or in terms, privileges, conditions of employment against any person otherwise qualified for lawful expression, expressive activity outside the workplace regarding a person's religious, political, or personal convictions, including the convictions about marriage, families, or sexualities. A significant protection. And then we protect religious organizations. We define them and cast a broad net over religious organizations and tried to give them that type of protection, carve them out, which I think is a First Amendment event anyway, but we reiterated it in statute. We then protected, again, the religion's requirement of providing goods, accommodations, or grounds. So the religious grounds and the facilities that they have, whether it's a Baptist wedding party or some other spot, those grounds and facilities are protected, and the religions can control what happens there. We then also protected the ability to counsel, the religious programs, the courses, as you see line 198, so significant that religions have the ability to counsel, give advice, and do it in a way that's conducive to their particular beliefs. Then schools. There's 57 religious affiliated elementary schools in Utah. 31, they serve 10,000 students. There's universities and other facilities. BYU's one of them. We protected and carved out the ability for those schools to be able to continue in a religious form and a religious format, both in employment and in housing. And that was a significant protection. And then we actually protected the Boy Scouts of America, which many would argue in this state is an affiliate of the religious community, whether it be Catholic or Mormon. We protected landlords. Small landlords, again, existing in our statute, were carved out under four dwelling units. So we protected them, or people that live in the same unit, they were carved out also, so they had that protection. We then, everybody talked about, I don't think anybody who listened to the press during the legislative session was unaware of the fact that we gave protections to the LGBT community in housing, and we gave protections to the LGBT community in employment. Now, many would argue, you know, we received our definition of marriage basically from Judge Shelby in a federal court decision in the December of 2013. Before that, we had a constitutional amendment defining marriage as between a man and a woman. Judge Shelby gave us same-sex marriage. People were worried about overturning of this particular statute. So we did something that was never done, I think, for a long time. We had attorneys in our state that said for 10 or 15 years they'd never heard of a non-severability clause. We actually put a non-severability clause in, which means that if any part of this is struck out, the rest of it goes away. So that's a very significant portion. You can't pick at the edges. You've got to take the whole package. And that was a real significant part of this piece of legislation. We then dealt in 297 with marriage. And there was a lot of confusion after the Shelby case as how we handle marriage. We simply did it in a very, what I would say, sophisticated, articulate way. But we mandated every clerk who issues a marriage license in the state of Utah, and some clerks were doing it, some clerks weren't, to marry. They had to be the Mary of last resort, period. But then we allowed them to step off if they wanted to, willing clerks, so it could be for any reason. They may not be necessarily comfortable in the public, or they just may have a deep-seated religious belief. That has worked extremely well. I could talk when we have time, maybe in question and answers, about what some of the counties are doing in the state of Utah. But again, the effort was to be balanced and fair, and we can do that in a very non-discriminatory fashion and still protect people's deep-seated religious beliefs. And then we did something that was significant in a non-professional, extremely significant, we allowed religions to be able to marry who and where they would like. In fact, in 185 it says that a local or state government cannot require a religious official, when acting as such, a religious organization, to solemnize a marriage for ecclesiastical purpose that is contrary to that religious official's or organization's religious beliefs. So we protected marriage. And then lastly, the thing that I'll talk about is we protected both the clerk and others in non-professional settings against government retaliation. And I might just read the bottom part of this science slide, starting on line 208. A state or local government may not deny, revoke, or suspend a license, professionals, or business licenses based on that licensee's belief or licensee's lawful expression of those beliefs in a non-professional setting. we protected those those that have licenses against government retaliation. Again, it was quite a compromise. We protected employers, we protected individuals, we protected employees, we protected religious organizations, we protected landlords, we gave protections to the LGBT community, we had a non-severability clause in it which allowed for that equalization. We dealt with marriage and how to handle that in the state of Utah, which we didn't have that challenge before, and we protect people against government retaliation. It was quite an effort. In my mind, we have a 45-day legislative session. We took this up on day two, which means there are, I guess, 43 days left. In reality, we only have 33 working days. We had 31 working days left. It was short, as you look around the nation, nothing short of miraculous that we were able to do this. So again, thank you for having me here.
So thank you. It's a privilege to be here with these gentlemen. For those of you who don't know, I think the Utah Compromise would not have happened without both of them, and I think it's extremely important. Is that where we're going? Okay, so I should just tell you a little bit about myself. I am the co-editor of a book about same-sex marriage and religious liberty, which goes all the way back to 2008. When we had the marriage cases coming down from California. In the short of that, in the space of that short time, we now have same-sex marriage around the country. We're gonna talk a little bit about the marriage decision tomorrow, I think, right? In a panel that Bob's moderating, and we're gonna talk in one of the plenaries a little bit more about the Utah Compromise. So I'm gonna try not to repeat what I'm gonna say in an hour. But I want to go back up to the 60,000 foot level and pick up with something that Mike said from one of the headlines. What was it that Utah did that was such an improvement upon the Indiana RFRA fight? Now, you know that the RFRA was ultimately signed into law in Indiana, but it was a bloody mess, right? And Utah managed to escape that entire hell to pay for trying to put marriage protections in place. I think it managed to escape that because it did something that was fundamentally decent. It extended rights to our LGBT neighbors while locking down protections around marriage. And this is a summary chart that I did of the Utah Compromise. I realize it's hard to read, but I'll at least try to orient you to it. And if you'd like it, I'll just email it to you, anybody who would like it. But let me spend a second on the RFRAs before I contrast them with the Utah Compromise. A Religious Freedom Restoration Act, right, is the statute that was at the heart of Hobby Lobby. It just applies strict scrutiny to anything that would strict scrutiny, in other words, you have to show a compelling interest in no less restrictive way, for the government to do anything that burdens religion. And that's a right and decent thing, right? These are statutes that were generally designed to protect religious minorities. Think of the Amish. Turns out the Amish like to run their little buggies down the road and they don't want to have orange safety triangles on them because they feel like that's flashy and it violates their religious convictions. And so they will say to the state, hey, could we just have a gray safety triangle and maybe a lantern at night? Now, most of us, I think, well, that's a no-brainer, right? If that accomplishes the safety end, why don't we do that? Now, that kind of statute, a Religious Freedom Restoration Act, was really non-controversial until essentially last February, not this February, but the February prior, when we had a fight in Arizona about cleaning up a little technical issue with a pre-existing RFRA, and that became the bloody mess before the bloody mess that we had in Indiana. Why? Because religious people themselves said in the public square that they need a RFRA to, quote, stave off gay rights. And that's lesson number one about the Utah Compromise. If you want religious protections to keep down the gay community, you will lose. Now, let me pause and say that if you think these statutes are really going to do that, they won't, right? So in a straight-up contest between a Religious Freedom Restoration Act right to discriminate and an anti-discrimination statute, the anti-discrimination statute will win. Even Doug Laycock, my co-author, the single most identified person with RFRA in the country, believes that to be true. So some religious people wanted these laws for the wrong reasons, believing that they could do things that they cannot in fact do. Those kinds of protections are called what I call general accommodations. In other words, they're a general rule to judges to try to figure it out for idiosyncratic cases that arise, like the Amish wanting to drive a buggy with a different color triangle. What Utah did is a specific exemption. Specific exemptions are written like rules. They're not tests or standards, they're rules. They say, this specific thing has to apply in these particular cases. Now, a reason a specific exemption is so much more preferable in a gay rights context than a RFRA is that they tell us on the face of the statute who does what. And that's important after a big marriage decision like the one we had a couple Fridays ago, because religious believers need to know what the rules of the road will be after same-sex marriage. They need to know, for example, if you look at the left side of this chart, 297, which is where the marriage conscience protections are, they need to know, as a senator said, and was made clear in the Utah Compromise, that clergy do not, in fact, have to marry anybody that they don't want to marry. Okay? Did not actually need that in 297, pardon to the senator for that, right? Because that would be in the First Amendment. And even though constitutional law professors seem to disagree on everything, this is the one thing they actually agree on, that you don't need that protection in the sanctuary. Where you do need that protection, and we've heard a lot about that at lunch and earlier this morning, is everywhere outside of the sanctuary. The tax exemption, for example, of the church organization itself gets protected in 297 with respect to this, to things that, if you look at the second column, a church might be asked to do, as the senator said, like host a wedding ceremony outside the sanctuary, on their grounds, right, or on a boardwalk pavilion, which we saw in a case called the Ocean Grove Methodist Ministry. This just clarifies that those, any kind of non-discrimination statute or other law that might force your hand to have to do something like that, that just doesn't apply because the specific exemption says so. Now, one of the reasons specific exemptions, I think, are more manageable than RFRAs is you know on the face of the statute itself what it's allowing you to have a pass or not have to do and what it's not. It gives notice to the public not to ask this church, for example, to use its grounds for a particular purpose if that's not what the church is fine with. It also allows you to tailor these rules to avoid hardships to the public that aren't necessary. For example, to tailor the rules so that you have in 297 the marriage function being performed by somebody, so that the state provides a forum of last resort to be married in this particular case in 297, the town clerk, the elected town clerk, if nobody else will do it, right? So it does allow you to clarify when duties start and when duties stop. That's actually what happened even in 296, which is the LGBT rights bill, or that part of it. So you have an extension of rights in hiring and housing to the LGBT community not to be discriminated against. And then there are specific carve-outs from that for things that were already in state law, like protections from small employers. And as the senator said, there's new protections now for religious institutions and educational societies, you know, evangelical schools, freestanding Catholic schools, and others. And that is not a pass from the law. It is not placing religious believers above the law, because it's on the face of the law, and it literally says the LGBT rights that we're extending and the protections that are being put in place vis-a-vis Red Robin and commercial businesses, we never meant them to apply, for example, to educational schools, and the law makes that clear at the beginning. Now, a lot of people, the senator talked about, and Mike talked both about, the fact that you had marriage here before you had the Utah Compromise. That's important. Utah was actually a pivot moment. Because in everywhere else in the United States that embraced voluntary same-sex marriage, they had a sexual orientation non-discrimination ban before they had marriage. And the reason that's significant is those bans applied to commercial services like burgers and taxis and renting large commercial apartments. They did not mean to, I think, apply to something that most people see as a religious sacrament like marriage. And so it was incumbent upon the voluntary same-sex marriage states to clarify that. They did that with the marriage protections, which are essentially replicated in 297 on the left-hand side of this chart. They say things like, if you did religious counseling before there was same-sex marriage, you can do religious counseling after. Now, many states that had same-sex marriage forced on them, think way back to Massachusetts, had that by judicial decision, and they did not follow on, as Utah did, with these kinds of protections. And that's unfortunate because these black hole states have literally no protections in the law for people who take a dissenting view. You heard this morning about how many people are now not religiously affiliated, okay? In the voluntary same-sex marriage states, all of those states were in the least religious states in America or in the middle quartile or middle third of the least religious states in America. That is not Utah. Utah is the second most religious state in America, second only to Mississippi. And we see now same-sex marriage rolling across the country in very religious red America. And backfilling with conscience protections, I think, is a really important thing to do, because you are going to have collisions that they would not have seen, for example, to the same degree in a New York. Those states, the voluntary same-sex marriage states, had thinner protections than you have in Utah. Utah actually took all of the same-sex marriage protections with a single exception, adoption, and instituted them here, and then they beefed them up, thickened them in important ways. So the senators already described some of them. I'll just describe them very briefly. They said that if you, as a state president, on a Sunday, make a statement about marriage that it should, for example, be between a man and a woman, you cannot lose your professional license on Monday. In 296 and in 297, they build in speech protections like that professional protection. So there are parity provisions in 296. What I mean by that is these are two-way street protections. They protect both the LGBT community and religious believers. So if I want in my workplace to wear my Equality Utah pin, I can wear it right next to my cross. And to the extent that employers allow one, they have to allow the other. Now, as the senator said, they can have a legitimate business reason for saying we ain't doing any of that here. But to the extent that they don't, they have to give same treatment to religious speech as to political speech. Outside the workplace, we heard this morning about Brendan Eich giving $1,000 to Prop 8. Can't fire somebody for doing that after the Utah Compromise. And neither can you fire the kid who works at Red Robin, who goes to a Equality Utah parade on the weekend and gets fired on Monday. That can't happen anymore either. Both of those things are decent, and I think they both hold the key to how you're going to export the Utah Compromise to the extent that it gets exported anywhere. And what I mean by that is I think you have to, the goal has to be for both sides to be decent, for both sides to find a way to live together in peace. And that isn't going to mean that you avoid judicial cramdowns, not here, but in some of these other states where I think it may be likely to happen. Now, the one thing holding those judicial cramdowns back is the risk of boycott, right, by corporate America, as we saw with Indiana. But I think it's completely unnecessary to do judicial cramdowns anyhow, because both sides can have their rights protected and religious liberty can coexist with LGBT rights. I think that's the lesson of the Utah Compromise, but it takes the hard work of stakeholders, as Mike and Senator Adams explained. And I'll leave it at that.
All right, thanks to our presenters for really clear and interesting and straightforward explanations of the Utah Compromise. Let's go ahead and open the floor to questions. I think what I'll do is gather three questions and then give the panel a chance to respond, and then we will repeat that if that's working well. Let's see if that happens or not. Who had their hand up right here? Do we have someone to help with the microphones? As you ask your question, if you wouldn't mind identifying yourself by name and where you're from. And if your question is directed at a specific individual, just let us know who that is. Could we change microphones? I don't think that one's working. There you go.
Hi, my name is Dino Ware. I'm from Michigan. With regards to the language, I noticed when it refers to religious officers, religious officials, it's always followed by when acting in such. And I guess in the Hosanna Tabor case, that was kind of one of the issues that a lot of the fighting took over with regards to the ministerial exception was, if you have a minister, or let's just take the Catholic Church, you have a priest who's coaching a basketball team, whether or not he's acting in such, and to what extent, what extent he comes under the scope of those laws or those exceptions.
Okay, thanks. Let's direct that to Senator Adams. Couple other questions.
Yeah, I think there was an effort to try to be fair, and I think we, as we moved through the process, we were trying to find a way to protect a religious official when acting as such, but again, trying to find a balance in that effort, and it was clear that if someone is acting as a religious official, they ought to be protected in what they're doing, but if they step outside of that role, that those, very clearly, those protections may not exist. I don't know if Robin has an additional comment.
Would the teacher in Hosanna Tabor be protected?
So, I mean, Hosanna Tabor, I read as saying that we're not going to generally second guess the labeling of that person as a called teacher. So you can't reach that. But to the extent that they're not acting in that capacity, they don't get the protections that we accord the church under the First Amendment.
Well,
and so that
I'm contrary to the ministerial exception.
I'm sorry, I can't see who's speaking.
No, I just said your statement about the minister with regards to the Hosanna Tabor case is correct, but with regards to the ministerial exception itself, that's not correct, because courts have held that organists can be covered under the exception as well as teachers. So from what I understand, just by the language and the statute, in Utah that would not be the case.
Well, I guess what I was trying to say, I think I faithfully described where the court came out in Hosanna Tabor. And I think the difficulty is a problem of labeling. In other words, if you are able to just throw a shield over everybody by calling them a called minister or a called teacher, then you overprotect potentially. You protect more than what they designed to protect. And the same challenge is in writing a statute. So what you're trying to protect is a person when acting as a religious figure. And you have, especially in Utah, where you have people who are private figures and religious figures, right? The same person. So on Sunday they are giving a sermon about marriage, and on Monday they're a real estate broker, right? One of those provisions was specifically trying to say don't take from them their professional license because you don't like what they say on the pulpit or, you know, in a sermon. But likewise, on the flip side of that, you don't want people to be engaging in things that is not part and parcel of their religious capacity and then hiding behind that religious capacity. And the classic piece would be in Hosanna Tabor, where they talk about what they reserve the idea that if somebody was sued for a tort, think the molestation cases in the Catholic Church. Obviously, whether they're a priest or not, they're not going to be protected by that, right? So you're going to have to draw lines because people just don't act purely in one capacity.
And that was the Obama administration's argument.
No, sir. I mean, I think they actually say in the decision that they're not answering what would happen in those kinds of cases if it was a tort. We could talk about the decision. Maybe I'm just not looking at the same part of it as you.
Chris Harrod, former Utah State Representative. This question's to Michael Purdy. And I guess the question that I have is, how do you still stand for truth you know, you look at what happened in Indiana and Louisiana. They were actually very minor changes what they did. And yet many of those individuals actually feel like we threw them under the bus. You look at the success, according to Dr. Monson, that the evangelical churches and the black churches have had in their belief in traditional marriage. There, in many cases, are the ones that are taking the brunt of it, and yet many feel abandoned as we present this. So how do you make sure that those individuals know that we support their cause, that we're behind them when we go down this path?
There have been a lot of discussions with church leaders of the LDS Church as well as other faiths around the country. I think they're very well aware of where we stand on marriage. As I said in my brief remarks, nothing has changed on our position on the marriage being between a man and a woman and our doctrine on that, and we made that very clear. But we also believe, as I said, that this fairness for all approach works in a democratic society. Not everyone is going to agree with that. And there have to be solutions found, and we thought that this was the best way forward without undermining our own doctrine.
Here and then back.
Michael Durham, Curtin McConkie. I'm interested in the exception, various protections placed on workers in workplace environments, but with exceptions for the legitimate business needs, and I don't think I caught the exact language, of employers. I'm thinking about conflicts like maybe the Mozilla one is emblematic, where not sure that it was, you know, employer driven. It was, you know, a huge response from the employer's customer base that suddenly says, hey, we're going to boycott you, we're going to have all sorts, there are going to be serious business repercussions if you continue to have this person in that position. And so I guess my question is, would this law allow an employer to have that be the business grounds for not for taking an action? Or does the employer have some sort of responsibility to stand up and not respond to those kind of threats of boycott?
Maybe we can pull back up 7 and 8, the slide 7 and 8, and walk down through those. But again, the efforts were to protect the employee in the workplace and the employer, protect the employee outside of the workplace and against government retaliation. But specifically in 296, it talked about expressions in the workplace. And if I can bring up, I think, slide 7, I hope it's that, Don. It says an employee maybe back.
Back one more.
Back one. Forward a couple. Okay, maybe one more. There we go. Even one beyond that, maybe. There we go, I think. So an employee may express, line 695, is that up there? It's hard to see behind me.
No, that's it. Which
one do you want? There it is. An employee may express the employee's religious or moral beliefs, and again, that's an equal protection effort to add moral beliefs in there, and commitments in the workplace in a reasonable, non-destructive, non-harassing way, which means you can't obviously harass or disrupt that workplace or harass your coworkers, on equal terms with similar types of expressions or beliefs or comments allowed by the employer in the workplace, unless the expressions are in direct conflict with the essential business-related interests of the employer. So again, trying to let the employer have control of that environment, but if they're gonna allow speech, you can't exclude religious speech if you're gonna allow that type of speech at the workplace. You can't discriminate against someone who has those deep-seated religious beliefs because you don't want them held or talked about at the workplace.
So I think the question is, under the Utah law, could Mozilla fire Brandon Eich on the essential business related interests grounds?
And it went further. Maybe we need to add to that. I think the next slide, I'm trying to find line 700, Don, if you can get it for me.
There, it's up now.
An employer, this is outside of the workplace, may not discharge, demote, terminate, or refuse to hire any person or retaliate against or harass or discriminate in matters of compensation or terms or privileges And again, this is for expression, as you go down to line 703, or activity outside of the workplace regarding the person's religious, political, or personal convictions. So I think it would cover that, in my opinion. So.
Michael, could you speak into a microphone, please?
Sorry. So I think, I mean, the basic rule certainly would cover the situation, but then there's this exception if that speech is in direct conflict with the essential business-related interests of the employer. And on one hand, you might say, well, Mozilla has no direct business-related interest in same-sex marriage one way or the other, except the question is, once it's got hundreds of potential users and customers saying, we're not going to use your product, so your revenues will fall by X thousand dollars if you keep this person in office, is that an essential business-related interest? Because it's why the employers make the decisions that they make, because they're looking at the financial bottom line.
You know, at least the intent that was expressed during the legislative session was not to disrupt the essential function of that business, and whether that is, I think, could be debated and probably will be perhaps litigated. But the intent was clearly to allow for that expression to happen outside of the workplace, but not to allow expression that was in direct conflict with that employer's essential function. And you didn't want somebody coming up and actually trying to destroy what their employer is trying to create and let the employer have some degree of control. But I don't think there was any intent of making it a popularity issue.
Professor Wilson.
So just to give an example, Michael, because I think you're asking the right question, which is, of course, the hard question. But in floor testimony and in the Senate hearings and in the House, the example that was given is that an employee should be able to wear their Equality Utah pin next to their cross so you get a level playing field inside the workplace. The same limitation applies both inside the workplace and out of the workplace. And on the inside the workplace example, what you should not be able to do is if you work at Planned Parenthood, for example, a person shouldn't be able to wear one of those fetus pins, you know, that you see outside the abortion clinics and be the receptionist at Planned Parenthood, because that obviously is in direct conflict with their essential business-related purposes. Now, ask yourself, if that applies both inside and outside the workplace, that suggests that you would, as an employer, have to establish what those limitations are ex ante. What happens in the Brendan Eich case was not an ex ante limitation, obviously, because it was before this law, but in effect, it's someone after the fact saying we're taking so much heat because of a political expression outside the workplace that we're going to ditch, we're going to get rid of this guy. That can't be, I would say, an essential business-related purpose because it wasn't established beforehand and it wasn't tied to their business model by the employer themselves. So that would be my argument.
So it would be fair to say that if Brendan Eich were fired for his political or religious speech, he would have a cause of action he could bring, and the burden would be upon the business to say this was an essential business interest. And it also might give them some backbone to stand up and say, we can't just fire this guy in the face of public pressure. But one thing to remember about the Brendan Eich situation is he ended up resigning in the face of that public pressure. And so in terms of a hypothetical, it's a little bit counterfactual to the situation we're describing. There were a couple questions up on the side here. Could I get one or two of you, maybe three of you, to ask your questions together, and then let's try to respond? The three of you right there together.
My question is, are there any of these religious protections that are specifically listed in this law that have been impacted by the Supreme Court decision? Or are they all standing secure and firm? Are they undermined or threatened in any way?
So you're talking about the Obergefell, the same-sex marriage decision that was
correct.
Just decided?
Okay. Correct. Has that had any impact on this compromise, on these compromise laws?
Okay, thank you. Next question. Quickly.
My question is more of the immigrant group. Some of the parents that are first-generation immigrant in this land, they don't understand what exactly is going on, even the language, what you are talking about. in their tradition, boy is boy, girl is girl. Why do you tell my children to adapt your whatever law you're talking about? If they're a teenager, the first generation, the second generation of the US citizen that had accidentally, as a teenager, violate some of these rules, who is going to come and teach these parents what to do to protect their children? This may not be the right place to talk about this, but I'm really concerned. Thank you.
Let's, Professor Wilson, ask you to address that question.
Jeff Shields from Orange County, California. In my fairly liberal controlled state, the dialogue has been exceptionally shrill between the right and the left, and on both sides, essentially, and often very personal and very attacking and very aggressive. A lot of us really like what happened in Utah with the Utah Compromise. Any suggestions as to how to start a good dialogue, a constructive dialogue between the opposite sides in California?
All right, let me let the panel address those three questions.
Maybe I'll take the first one very briefly. During last legislative session, I think we mentioned before that Judge Shelby gave us same-sex marriage in Utah. We had a constitutional amendment indicating that marriage between a man and a woman. We lost the appeal of that Judge Shelby case. And waiting for the Supreme Court, during the legislative session, same-sex marriage was legal. Everything we did assumed that that was the case. So nothing the Supreme Court did overturned what we did. In fact, many of you might be aware there was a police officer that talked about losing his job because he didn't want to ride in he would work the gay parade, but he wouldn't want to ride and do maneuvers in the gay parade. Coincidentally, they offered that service again from the Salt Lake Police Force this year, and I don't think either Robin or Michael know about it, but when 296 and 297 had passed, the Salt Lake Police Department said, we're gonna bring that back to our employees. They have a say in this. We have 296 that says we can have expression about this religious events at the workplace. So they took it back to the police officers were gonna ride. They decided not to do the maneuvers. And that was a positive effect of 296 and 297, that those maneuvers were not done this year. They were not directly protected, but indirectly protected in the fact that what we did resonated through the community. I'll let Robin take the effort, I think, on
education.
Go ahead.
So I feel for you as a parent. I mean, this is probably the single most momentous decision that is going to be made in family law, maybe in my lifetime. And the court doesn't do a terribly good job of telling people why. It wants to have its cake and eat it too, in the sense that it says, oh, there's a fundamental right to marry. That's something you can explain to your children. But they don't really want to say why. And it's going to be a difficult question. Now, one of the things I do think that is worthy of the Kennedy decision is what it has to say about marriage in a sense, a deeply conservative way, where it says that marriage is there for the protection of adults, but particularly what it says about how marriage is there for the protection of children. So whatever else we think about the one man, one woman, boy is boy, girl is girl, there are things in that decision about marriage that I think are really powerful and emotive and are worthy of remark. It has always been the case, with the exception of things that do rise to the level of a fundamental right, that states decide who can do what. So we have some states, when I first started teaching in South Carolina, that said that the age of marriage was 12 for girls and 14 for boys. I was surprised at the time. During my time there, they made it 16 for both genders. And no one even pauses over state-level rules like that. Some states say first cousins can marry, some states don't. So it's not a very satisfying decision. It's a hard one to understand, even for legal scholars, to decide what it means, especially the signals that it gives for whether we're going to have to embrace polygamous marriage, for example.
Mr. Purdy, would you like to address the question about exporting the lessons or the tone of dialogue?
Yeah, I feel uniquely qualified to talk about California politics. As I said in my remarks, I do think this is something that can be replicated in other states, and I don't say that lightly. It is a very and was a very difficult process, but as I said, it's and I think all of the panelists here have said today, it's one that's based on these fundamental American ideals of fairness and justice and compromise and equality and all of those things that people want to accomplish. I think too often the shrill voices, as you've described, are getting so much of the attention, and yet, based on the reaction after the so-called Utah Compromise passed, it was like, wow, somebody finally found a solution. I think people are hungry for this type of solution. How to take the dialogue away from kind of the shrill voices, I'm not sure I can answer that. Maybe my colleagues here
Senator
have some
Adams,
thoughts
do you
on
have
that.
Anything to add to that question?
We're going to talk more about that. I guess there's a session later on as to how we might export this. But one thing for sure that can just be said, I don't think you can export any of this. We just celebrated the 4th of July. I'm going to read from the Declaration of Independence. It says, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men were created equal, that they are endowed by a creator with certain unalienable rights. Among them are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." If you don't look at a fairness for all issue, you're going to get a legal problem. And if you don't try to look at things through someone else's eyes, and I may pull up where the end of the program, and I may just pull up a quote from somebody some of you may know. He's a pretty significant person in my life, but his name is Dieter, Elder President Uchtdorf. But he talked about his efforts and what he thought ought to be done. But he simply said the effort to throw off the traditions of distrust and pettiness and truly see another with new eyes, see each other not as aliens or adversaries. And quite frankly, we have 24 members of a 29-member Senate that are Republican, 63 of 75 in the House. We can step on people if we want. But many times we want to look at people as aliens and adversaries. But he says, but look at them as travelers, brothers and sisters, children of God. It's one of the biggest challenges we face, but one of the most rewarding and ennobling. And then he says something that has resonated with me. He's got a German descent. He lived through the World War II. He lived through Hitler. He says, "I'm convinced that had my countrymen felt and applied the power of divine love and compassion, that the Holocaust would never have happened." Wow. The evil that befell the world could have been prevented. Such heartache would never have descended upon the planet. And if we don't elevate our view beyond just what we believe, and try to look at things through other people's eyes. It's the hardest thing I did during a legislative session was to try to do that, because I was actually formatted and ready to go another direction. But to be able to do that as a society and as individuals will reap great benefits. And I think if we're gonna move to other states and if we're gonna have success around the nation, we have to do it in that spirit and that effort.
We're just about out of time. We've had one person waiting patiently for an opportunity to ask a question.
Yeah, just real quickly, my name is Brian Scroggins from Las Vegas, Nevada. I owned a sign business for 20 years in Nevada, and I never had anyone ask me to do anything, print up a sign or make a banner, other than adult-oriented material that I refused to do. And I don't know if I did that because I was a bishop or because I was a high counselor or because I just didn't want to do it because my wife worked with me in the business. But did this legislation have any kind of protection where if a person came in and wanted again, to make a cake, make a banner, make something, and they said, "I really don't want to do that."
So conscience protections for small business owners.
We exempted the employment and housing out of the small business owner, but we didn't deal with public accommodations. We didn't take that on last legislative session. Many people would like us to. I'm not sure what the future is, but we didn't deal with that.
All right, let me ask you to join me in thanking our panel, and we will take a 15-minute break. Again, we have three different panels that will be repeated twice, so feel free to choose one of the other three or to reattend this one if you'd like.
I do.
Okay, I'm Brian Schreiner. He helped me, kind of sort of helped me know how to put up a campaign.
I actually.
He'll be here tomorrow.
Yeah, he'll be here tomorrow. Yeah, I hope you'll see him. He's a fine person.
Yeah. He was partners with the Judy Burrell's group.
Yeah.
And Judy, I just saw her the other day down there.
Highly relevant. Okay, I need to look it up.
Yeah, great. church is uniquely qualified.
No, I was trying to make a joke. It didn't go well.
Hi, how are you?